Chapter 57. Our cousin of Scotland was ugly, awkward, and shuffling both in mind and person. His tongue was much too large for his mouth, his legs were much too weak for his body, and his dull goggle eyes stared and rolled like an idiot's. He was cunning, covetous, wasteful, idle, drunken, greedy, dirty, cowardly, a great swearer, and the most conceited man on earth. His figure, what is commonly called rickety from his birth, presented a most ridiculous appearance, dressed in thick padded clothes, as a safeguard against being stabbed, of which he lived in continual fear, of a grass-green color from head to foot, with a hunting horn dangling at his side instead of a sword, and his hat and feather sticking over one eye, or hanging on the back of his head, as he happened to toss it on. He used to loll on the necks of his favorite courtiers, and slobber their faces, and kiss and pinch their cheeks, and the greatest favorite he ever had, used to sign himself in his letters to his royal master, his majesty's dog and slave, apostrophe, and used to address his majesty as his soship. Apostrophe, his majesty was the worst writer ever seen, and thought himself the best. He was one of the most impertinent talkers in the broadest Scotch ever heard, and boasted of being unanswerable in all manner of argument. He wrote some of the most wearisome treatises ever read among others, a book upon witchcraft, in which he was a devout believer, and thought himself a prodigy of authorship. He thought, and wrote, and said, that a king had a right to make and unmake what laws he pleased, and ought to be accountable to nobody on earth. This is the plain, true character of the personage whom the greatest men about the court praised and flattered to that degree, that I doubt if there be anything much more shameful in the annals of human nature. He came to the English throne with great ease. The miseries of a disputed succession had been felt so long, and so dreadfully, that he was proclaimed within a few hours of Elizabeth's death, and was accepted by the nation, even without being asked to give any pledge, that he would govern well, or that he would redress crying grievances. He took a month to come from Edinburgh to London, and, by way of exercising his new power, hanged a pickpocket on the journey without any trial, and knighted everybody he could lay hold of. He made 200 knights before he got to his palace in London, and 700 before he had been in it 3 months. He also shoveled 62 new peers into the House of Lords, and there was a pretty large sprinkling of Scotchmen among them, you may believe. His soship's prime minister, Cecil, for I cannot do better than call his majesty what his favorite called him, was the enemy of Sir Walter Raleigh, and also of Sir Walter's political friend, Lord Cobham, and his soship's first trouble was a plot originated by these two, and entered into by some others, with the old object of seizing the king and keeping him in imprisonment until he should change his ministers. There were Catholic priests in the plot, and there were Puritan noblemen too, for, although the Catholics and Puritans were strongly opposed to each other, they united at this time against his soship, because they knew that he had a design against both, after pretending to be friendly to each, this design being to have only one high and convenient form of the Protestant religion, which everybody should be bound to belong to, whether they liked it or not. This plot was mixed up with another, which may or may not have had some reference to placing on the throne, at some time, the Lady Arabella Stuart, whose misfortune it was to be the daughter of the younger brother of his soship's father, but who was quite innocent of any part in the scheme. Sir Walter Raleigh was accused on the confession of Lord Cobham, a miserable creature, who said one thing at one time, and another thing at another time, and could be relied upon in nothing. The trial of Sir Walter Raleigh lasted from 8 in the morning until nearly midnight. He defended himself with such eloquence, genius, and spirit against all accusations, and against the insults of Coke, the Attorney General, who, according to the custom of the time, foully abused him, that those who went there detesting the prisoner came away admiring him, and declaring that anything so wonderful and so captivating was never heard. He was found guilty, nevertheless, and sentenced to death. Execution was deferred, and he was taken to the tower. The two Catholic priests, less fortunate, were executed with the usual atrocity, and Lord Cobham and two others were pardoned on the scaffold. His Soship thought it wonderfully knowing in him to surprise the people by pardoning these three at the very block, but, blundering and bungling, as usual, he had very nearly overreached himself. For, the messenger on horseback who brought the pardon came so late that he was pushed to the outside of the crowd, and was obliged to shout and roar out what he came for. The miserable Cobham did not gain much by being spared that day. He lived, both as a prisoner and a beggar, utterly despised, and miserably poor, for 13 years, and then died in an old outhouse belonging to one of his former servants. This plot got rid of, and Sir Walter Raleigh safely shut up in the tower, his Soship held a great dispute with the Puritans on their presenting a petition to him, and had it all his own way, not so very wonderful, as he would talk continually, and would not hear anybody else, and filled the bishops with admiration. It was comfortably settled that there was to be only one form of religion, and that all men were to think exactly alike. But, although this was arranged 2 centuries and a half ago, and although the arrangement was supported by much fining and imprisonment, I do not find that it is quite successful, even yet. His Soship, having that uncommonly high opinion of himself as a king, had a very low opinion of Parliament as a power that audaciously wanted to control him. When he called his first Parliament, after he had been king a year, he accordingly thought he would take pretty high ground with them, and told them that he commanded them as an absolute king. Apostrophe the Parliament thought those strong words, and saw the necessity of upholding their authority. His Soship had 3 children, Prince Henry, Prince Charles, and the Princess Elizabeth. It would have been well for one of these, and we shall too soon see which, if he had learned a little wisdom concerning parliaments from his father's obstinacy. Now, the people still laboring under their old dread of the Catholic religion, this parliament revived and strengthened the severe laws against it. And this so angered Robert Catesby, a restless Catholic gentleman of an old family, that he formed one of the most desperate and terrible designs ever conceived in the mind of man, no less a scheme than the gunpowder plot. His object was, when the king, lords, and commons should be assembled at the next opening of Parliament, to blow them up, one and all, with a great mine of gunpowder. The first person to whom he confided this horrible idea was Thomas Winter, a Worcestershire gentleman who had served in the army abroad, and had been secretly employed in Catholic projects. While Winter was yet undecided, and when he had gone over to the Netherlands, to learn from the Spanish ambassador there whether there was any hope of Catholics being relieved through the intercession of the King of Spain with his Soship, he found at Ostend a tall, dark, daring man, whom he had known when they were both soldiers abroad, and whose name was Guido or Guy Fawkes. Resolved to join the plot, he proposed it to this man, knowing him to be the man for any desperate deed, and they two came back to England together. Here, they admitted 2 other conspirators, Thomas Percy, related to the Earl of Northumberland, and John Wright, his brother-in-law. All these met together in a solitary house in the open fields which were then near Clement's Inn, now a closely blocked up part of London. And when they had all taken a great oath of secrecy, Catesby told the rest what his plan was. They then went upstairs into a garret, and received the sacrament from Father Gerard, a Jesuit, who is said not to have known actually of the gunpowder plot, but who, I think, must have had his suspicions that there was something desperate afoot. Percy was a gentleman pensioner, and as he had occasional duties, to perform about the court, then kept at Whitehall, there would be nothing suspicious in his living at Westminster. So, having looked well about him, and having found a house to let, the back of which joined the Parliament House, he hired it of a person named Ferris, for the purpose of undermining the wall. Having got possession of this house, the conspirators hired another on the Lambeth side of the Thames, which they used as a storehouse for wood, gunpowder, and other combustible matters. These were to be removed at night and afterwards were removed, bit by bit, to the house at Westminster, and, that there might be some trusty person, to keep watch over the Lambeth stores, they admitted another conspirator, by name Robert Kay, a very poor Catholic gentleman. All these arrangements had been made some months, and it was a dark, wintry, December night, when the conspirators, who had been in the meantime dispersed to avoid observation, met in the house at Westminster, and began to dig. They had laid in a good stock of eatables, to avoid going in and out, and they dug and dug with great ardor. But, the wall being tremendously thick, and the work very severe, they took into their plot Christopher Wright, a younger brother of John Wright, that they might have a new pair of hands to help. And Christopher Wright fell to like a fresh man, and they dug and dug by night and by day, and Fox stood sentinel all the time. And if any man's heart seemed to fail him at all, Fox said, "Gentlemen, we have abundance of powder and shot here, and there is no fear of our being taken alive, even if discovered." Apostrophe the same Fox, who, in the capacity of sentinel, was always prowling about, soon picked up the intelligence that the king had prorogued the Parliament again, from the 7th of February, the day first fixed upon, until the 3rd of October. When the conspirators knew this, they agreed to separate until after the Christmas holidays, and to take no notice of each other in the meanwhile, and never to write letters to one another on any account. So, the house in Westminster was shut up again, and I suppose the neighbors thought that those strange-looking men who lived there so gloomily, and went out so seldom, were gone away to have a merry Christmas somewhere. It was the beginning of February, 1605, when Catesby met his fellow conspirators again at this Westminster house. He had now admitted three more. John Grant, a Warwickshire gentleman of a melancholy temper, who lived in a doleful house near Stratford-upon-Avon, with a frowning wall all round it, and a deep moat. Robert Winter, eldest brother of Thomas, and Catesby's own servant, Thomas Bates, who, Catesby thought, had had some suspicion of what his master was about. These three had all suffered more or less for their religion in Elizabeth's time. And now, they all began to dig again, and they dug and dug by night and by day. They found it dismal work alone there, underground, with such a fearful secret on their minds, and so many murders before them. They were filled with wild fancies. Sometimes, they thought they heard a great bell tolling, deep down in the earth under the Parliament House. Sometimes, they thought they heard low voices muttering about the gunpowder plot. Once in the morning, they really did hear a great rumbling noise over their heads, as they dug and sweated in their mine. Every man stopped and looked aghast at his neighbor, wondering what had happened, when that bold prowler, Fox, who had been out to look, came in and told them that it was only a dealer in coals who had occupied a cellar under the Parliament House, removing his stock in trade to some other place. Upon this, the conspirators, who with all their digging and digging had not yet dug through the tremendously thick wall, changed their plan, hired that cellar, which was directly under the House of Lords, put 36 barrels of gunpowder in it, and covered them over with faggots and coals. Then they all dispersed again till September, when the following new conspirators were admitted. Sir Edward Bainham, of Gloucestershire. Sir Everard Digby, of Rutlandshire. Ambrose Rookwood, of Suffolk, Francis Tresham, of Northamptonshire. Most of these were rich, and were to assist the plot, some with money and some with horses on which the conspirators were to ride through the country, and rouse the Catholics after the Parliament should be blown into air. Parliament being again prorogued from the 3rd of October to the 5th of November, and the conspirators being uneasy lest their design should have been found out, Thomas Winter said he would go up into the House of Lords on the day of the prorogation, and see how matters looked. Nothing could be better. The unconscious commissioners were walking about and talking to one another, just over the 36 barrels of gunpowder. He came back, and told the rest so, and they went on with their preparations. They hired a ship, and kept it ready in the Thames, in which Fox was to sail for Flanders, after firing with a slow match the train, that was to explode the powder. A number of Catholic gentlemen not in the secret, were invited, on pretense of a hunting party, to meet Sir Everard Digby at Dunchurch on the fatal day, that they might be ready to act together. And now all was ready. But now, the great wickedness and danger which had been all along at the bottom of this wicked plot, began to show itself. As the 5th of November drew near, most of the conspirators, remembering that they had friends and relations who would be in the House of Lords that day, felt some natural relenting, and a wish to warn them to keep away. They were not much comforted by Catesby's declaring that in such a cause he would blow up his own son. Lord Mountagle, Tresham's brother-in-law, was certain to be in the house, and when Tresham found that he could not prevail upon the rest to devise any means of sparing their friends, he wrote a mysterious letter to this lord, and left it at his lodging in the dusk, urging him to keep away from the opening of Parliament, since God and man had concurred to punish the wickedness of the times. Apostrophe it contained the words, that the Parliament should receive a terrible blow, and yet should not see who hurt them. Apostrophe and it added, the danger is past, as soon as you have burnt the letter. Apostrophe, the ministers and courtiers made out that his soulship, by a direct miracle from heaven, found out what this letter meant. The truth is, that they were not long, as few men would be, in finding out for themselves, and it was decided to let the conspirators alone, until the very day before the opening of Parliament. That the conspirators had their fears, is certain, for Tresham himself said before them all, that they were every one dead men, and, although even he did not take flight, there is reason to suppose, that he had warned other persons besides Lord Mountagle. However, they were all firm, and Fox, who was a man of iron, went down every day and night, to keep watch in the cellar as usual. He was there about 2, in the afternoon of the 4th, when the Lord Chamberlain and Lord Mountagle threw open the door and looked in. Who are you, friend? Apostrophe apostrophe said they. Why, apostrophe said Fox, I am Mr. Percy's servant, and am looking after his store of fuel here. Apostrophe your master has laid in a pretty good store, apostrophe they returned, and shut the door, and went away. Fox, upon this, posted off to the other conspirators, to tell them all was quiet, and went back, and shut himself up in the dark, black cellar again, where he heard the bell go 12 o'clock and usher in the 5th of November. About 2 hours afterwards, he slowly opened the door, and came out to look about him, in his old prowling way. He was instantly seized and bound by a party of soldiers under Sir Thomas Knevet. He had a watch upon him, some touch wood, some tinder, some slow matches, and there was a dark lantern with a candle in it, lighted, behind the door. He had his boots and spurs on to ride to the ship, I suppose, and it was well for the soldiers that they took him so suddenly. If they had left him but a moment's time to light a match, he certainly would have tossed it in among the powder, and blown up himself and them. They took him to the king's bedchamber first of all, and there the king, causing him to be held very tight, and keeping a good way off, asked him how he could have the heart to intend to destroy so many innocent people? Because, apostrophe said Guy Fawkes, desperate diseases need desperate remedies. Apostrophe to a little Scotch favorite, with a face like a terrier, who asked him with no particular wisdom why he had collected so much gunpowder, he replied, because he had meant to blow Scotchmen back to Scotland, and it would take a deal of powder to do that. Next day he was carried to the Tower, but would make no confession. Even after being horribly tortured, he confessed nothing that the government did not already know, though he must have been in a fearful state, as his signature, still preserved, in contrast with his natural handwriting, before he was put upon the dreadful rack, most frightfully shows. Bates, a very different man, soon said the Jesuits had had to do with the plot, and probably, under the torture, would as readily have said anything. Tresham, taken and put in the Tower too, made confessions and unmatum, and died of an illness that was heavy. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.